On the Commons is a weekly radio show dedicated to discussing the many issues surrounding mandatory common ownership developments. It is broadcast live from WEBR Fairfax, Virginia. Join us as we explore the world of common ownership developments, the fastest growing form of residential development in America today. This housing concept includes condominiums, cooperatives, and both attached and detached single family homes that are part of a mandatory homeowners association. Unfortunately, this type of housing is not as utopian as its advocates would have us believe. Living in a mandatory homeowners association means giving up part of the American dream. It means giving up constitutional rights and control over one's most valuable asset, one's home. Living in a mandatory homeowners association means leaving the American zone. WEBR Fairfax Radio, you're on the Commons. I'm Sue Bartholomew. On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions. And on the Commons today with us is Tony Bays. Tony is the Assistant Director for the Kentucky Fair Housing Council. It's a not-for-profit, private not-for-profit agency dedicated to eradicating housing discrimination in Kentucky and southern Indiana. That's one hell of a mission statement right there, Tony.
I'm sorry, I'm having a little trouble hearing you, Sue.
I'm sorry, is that better?
A little bit, yes.
I just read from your press release that introduced you, said the Kentucky Fair Housing Council is a private not-for-profit agency dedicated to eradicating housing discrimination in Kentucky and southern Indiana. And I said that's a great mission to have, a great goal to have.
Yes, it is. Unfortunately, our caseload is larger than it's ever been in our 10-year history. At this point, discrimination, unfortunately, is still big business in this country, especially when it comes to people searching for housing.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about your agency? And it's unusual because I didn't realize that it was a private agency. I thought it was a government agency when I first saw this press release.
Well, we are a private nonprofit agency. We do receive money from the federal government to investigate claims of housing discrimination. Essentially, our agency is charged to enforce the law. We're essentially a private attorney general's office. People who are discriminated against can come to us. We'll help them investigate their complaints. We'll help them file complaints with either the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development or in court. And we'll see them through the process and provide them with legal assistance along the way.
How did you get involved in this?
Me personally?
Well, yeah, and why did you see a need for, I mean, how did the agency become involved in all of this? How did it get created? How did you personally get involved in this?
Well, the agency was created in 1991, a couple years after the Fair Housing Act was amended at the federal level to add protections for family status and disability. There are approximately 200 agencies like ours around the country, private nonprofit agencies that seek to enforce the Fair Housing Act and all of its amendments. There is just a huge need for this type of work to be done. And Congress, when it established the Fair Housing Initiatives Program in the early 1990s, it created a program specifically to fund groups like ours to investigate complaints, to help people understand their rights as they are regarding fair housing. There was a huge need seen all the way, you know, even during Republican presidents, that this type of work needed to be done, and that people were still having a tough time even after all the turmoil in the 60s and the original Fair Housing Act passing in 1968, people were still having a tough time finding housing without discrimination. Myself, I got involved in fair housing about a year after I got out of college. The Kentucky Fair Housing Council was looking for somebody to do its publications, and I have a publications background, and I got on board, and a few years down the road, I was promoted and took over the investigative side as well.
So you actually do the investigations?
Right. We have a staff of five people at the Fair Housing Council. essentially, I'm the assistant director. I oversee the day-to-day operations, but we have a test coordinator. She is the point person for the investigations. If someone calls and has a complaint, they'll typically talk to her. And then what she'll do is she'll assign undercover investigators to go out and check to see if the person's story checks out. For instance, if an African-American person called us and said that they had just looked for an apartment to rent, and that even though there was a for rent sign out front, when they went in to ask about it, the manager or whoever they spoke with said it was no longer available. Well, in a situation like that, we would send an African-American investigator out, in addition to a white investigator, and see what they were told. Now, if the white investigator was told that the apartment was still available and the African-American investigator was told that the apartment was not, we'd have some pretty good evidence that racial discrimination was occurring.
You just had a very successful case that involved a mother with five children.
Right.
And did you personally investigated this?
Yes. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, you want to tell us about it?
Absolutely. This case came to us, it was a referral from a legal aid attorney in Louisville, Kentucky. She called to say that she had gotten a call from a woman who was being evicted, and that the woman felt that she was being evicted because she had five children. Not simply because she had children, but because she had too many children. We investigated the case. We did send investigators out. We weren't too successful in our undercover investigation because the park, the mobile home park where the woman lived was fairly poorly run. So our investigators never got to talk to the manager or the owner of the park. But our investigation did reveal that the owner had park rules in place, printed and distributed to all the residents, that had rules in them that were anti-children. Things that said families were not allowed to have more than two children, that each child would be charged additional rent, you know, like a $5 per head fee. Children were not allowed to play outside. Children were not allowed to be out after dark. Children were not allowed to have bicycles. All these things were in print in the park rules. And that is essentially what won the case for us. We filed a federal lawsuit against the mobile home park, and a few months later, it settled. And if it weren't for the owner being brazen enough, I guess, to put these anti-children rules in print, we would have had a much tougher time with the investigation and with the case.
So this case actually settled. It never did go to court, right?
We had one hearing before the judge in which the judge reviewed the park rules and advised the defendant attorney that it appeared that the defendant was in serious trouble. the judge didn't make a ruling, but he did look at the rules and say that it appeared to him that the rules might violate the Fair Housing Act. You know, of course, they obviously did. It's illegal to discriminate against families with children, and it's illegal to put any types of terms or conditions on families with children you wouldn't put on anybody else. It wasn't too long after that meeting that we got an offer from the mobile home park owner to give the woman $5,000 in cash and allow her to live at the mobile home park for 10 years rent-free. And that's, we decided to settle the case for that.
In your opinion, Tony, had this gone to court and had it been decided by a judge, do you suppose she might have got more?
In my opinion, yes, she probably would have gotten more.
Okay.
You know, again, it's hard to predict these types of things. You can always get a conservative judge who doesn't want to award a lot of punitive damages. You can always get a jury who doesn't feel that discrimination against children is as harming or as damaging as discrimination against other types of people. But yes, in my opinion, if it had proceeded to court, she probably would have gotten a larger judgment. But based on the park owner's income and his financial situation, we felt that even if we had gone to court and gotten a larger judgment, he may not have been able to pay it, and that this offer of free rent and the $5,000 was probably about the best we could do, given this guy's financial situation.
Well, also the fact that this lady was able to get on with her life and not have this hang over her head forever and a day.
Exactly. Federal court cases tend to take years.
Yeah.
And if we have a lot of experience in federal court at the Fair Housing Council, and if defendants get good attorneys or just want to stall a case, it's very easy for somebody who did a really bad thing to stall a case out, continually request extensions for deadlines on different motions and things. And we have a case now that's been dragging on for nearly 5 years because the defendants have played a stall game. And we're glad that we were able to get Ms. Webb's money to her and get her a settlement within a few months of filing the complaint.
Oh, I think there's a lot to be said for that, and just get her up. When I talked to you the other day, I had read your press release when you first sent it out, and I, read a lot of stuff since then. I didn't remember the details, and I had just basically called you before rereading this, and I promised you I would reread this and know it very, be very familiar with it when we talk today. This notion that children must be off the street by sunset. All youth, 16 of age or older, must be off the streets by 10 p.m. They can't play here. I mean, that in and of itself sounds really horrible.
Right. And there are cases like that around the country where landlords and mobile home park owners or condominium association board members or homeowners association board members, they view these rules as reasonable. And they think, well, we let kids in here, but we don't have to let them play outside.
That's right.
And that's just not the way the law works. The law says that you can't treat families with children any differently than you would treat any other tenant. If the rules had said no person may be on the street after sunset, then the rule would have been, probably rejected by the adult.
Well, then the ACLU, then the ACLU would have been involved.
Right, exactly.
And they would have gotten... actually, I have a friend who's got... her son is 16 now, but she's been fighting her condominium since he was 2 because they wouldn't allow him to be out in the... There's a grassy area behind their condominium. And they decided they didn't want kids there. This little kid was playing ball, and they just... didn't want the kids out there, so they planted trees. They had the, security come and get them. In a situation like that, would you get involved if it were a condominium?
I think we would. And I know that in Virginia, there are two agencies like ours. There is the Fair Housing Center of North Virginia in Fairfax, and there is the Housing Opportunities Made Equal of Richmond. I think either those two agencies would be interested to hear cases like that, where condo associations have limited the areas in which children can play. There have been cases all around the country like ours, cases out in California. Name a state and you can find a case where someone has brought a complaint because a housing provider or the association board was limiting the places children can play. We currently have a case in Kentucky against a homeowners association, a condo association, where they would not allow a man to put a swing set in his own backyard for his children. And after our investigation, began, we realized that they were approving other types of structures. If you wanted to put a bird bath or an arboretum or an awning on your home, you're allowed to do that. But if you requested a swing set or a basketball goal or anything that was related to children, the board would deny it. And the board president actually admitted as such in an open meeting among the owners. He said that they weren't going to approve any type of kid stuff. That's discrimination against families with children. And that kind of stuff isn't allowed and should not be going on in places where there are associations. But literally, I think if we heard of a case where an association said, no, your kids can't play in this area, then yes, we would definitely get involved and start an investigation.
What about the reverse? What about if you have, say, a development with predominantly young families with children and with, say, a couple of older homeowners?
Right.
And all of a sudden, everybody's got kid stuff, tot lots and swing sets and playhouses and basketball hoops, and yet an older couple wants to put up a structure. They don't have kids. And all of a sudden, they're not allowed to put it up. Would you get involved? Do you think there would be discrimination in that case, but it would be age discrimination?
Well, yeah, I would.
Because I've got a case like that right now. I mean, I know of a case like that right now.
Okay.
Where the homeowners put up not an arboretum, a sort of something for her plants. And the association doesn't like it, yet everybody around her has got basketball hoops and all kinds of things, kid-related.
Well, yeah, that's a very interesting case. Now, on the federal level, it would be impossible for the older persons to assert a claim. In order to have standing to file a family status complaint, you actually have to have somebody in your household under the age of 18. Family status doesn't apply to people without children. But I do know in Virginia, under Virginia's state fair housing law, there is protections for persons over the age of 55.
Mm-hmm.
They call it there's no discrimination against the elderly.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if I would classify people 55 and older as elderly, but that is in Virginia state law. So I would think that if the people you're speaking of were to contact either the Fair Housing Center of Northern Virginia or Home of Richmond, depending on what part of the state they're in, I think they would look at the case. I think it could be shown that there is age discrimination there, that if basketball goals and swing sets are allowed, but I guess more adult structures are not allowed, I would say, and assuming that these folks are over the age of 55, I would think that the Fair Housing Centers in Virginia would take a look at it.
I think that, what you know, the way my husband put it was, we're allowing, you know, we're discriminating against people who want to raise flowers instead of children.
Right.
You know, and that's essentially what it amounts to. You know, there's plenty of room there for them to do that.
Right.
Well, that's good to know. Tony, you were talking about the federal fair housing laws and then state fair housing laws. And I'm aware of some of the differences here, but what you want to tell us a little bit about the differences? And you don't have to limit it to Virginia or Kentucky, but just basically the differences between federal and state and how they come into play here.
Okay. Essentially, the Federal Fair Housing Act was originally passed in 1968. It protected four classes of people. It protected on the basis of race, color, national origin, and religion. In 1974, it was amended to add protections for sex discrimination. And in 1988, it was amended again to add protections for family status and disability. The biggest differences between state laws and the federal law is that state laws often go further than the Federal Fair Housing Act goes. The Federal Fair Housing Act only pertains to those seven protected classes I mentioned. State laws, like Virginia's, goes further to protect the elderly. Many state laws around the country, I know Illinois has added military status, marital status, age, and dishonorable discharge status from the military. So it's illegal in Illinois to deny somebody housing because they were dishonorably discharged from the military.
How would you go about knowing something like that?
That's a really good question. I don't know, and I often wonder why Illinois felt it necessary to pass that that law. I'd love to go back in the legislative history of Illinois and figure that out. I assume that on certain rental applications or certain homeowners applications, it may ask, you know, what is your military status? Were you discharged honorably? And if somebody put no, you wouldn't be able to discriminate against them in Illinois.
But, Tony, why would anybody even answer that?
Exactly.
that's none of your business.
Right. I don't know. I assume that the legislators in Illinois saw some problem when they decided to add that protection to their fair housing law, but I don't know what it was. Of course, other states and cities around the country have added protection for sexual orientation. It goes even further in large cities like Washington, D.C. and New York, where they've added political affiliation and...
Oh, have they really?
Yes. You can't discriminate in Washington, D.C. against Republicans or Democrats or Libertarians or Green parties, I guess.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Right. It has gone even further than the federal act is in many cities and states around the country.
Well, I knew that state laws generally did take it a step beyond. So if you're looking at, say, a religious discrimination, presumably you would have it in the Kentucky laws. Would you take it to the federal court? Would you feel more comfortable in federal court? Does it matter? Why would you pick one jurisdiction over another?
Well, for strategic reasons, we file more cases in federal court.
Okay.
And I guess the biggest reason there is that when people have a lawsuit filed against them in federal court, they sit up and take notice. To be quite honest with you, the cases that we file with the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, people don't really jump when those notices arrive in their mail. They don't understand what's going on. They don't realize that it's essentially the same thing as having a federal lawsuit filed against you. And there's several reasons for that, which I won't get into. But we typically file in federal court because the recoveries for the victims we represent are higher in federal court, and you can get on a faster track in federal court. Although federal court is very slow, it's often much, much slower in state courts, which have to deal with many, many more things than the federal courts do. But from a strategic standpoint, federal court tends to make people sit up and take notice and get to the bargaining table a bit quicker than state court or a complaint filed with HUD.
That's interesting. I've also had some questions about how much interaction there tends to be with the attorneys representing the developers or landlords or whatever and the judges. And I don't know if you've run into that problem. I know that in a lot of states, I hear from a lot of people who say, hey, wait a minute, you know, the judge on my case used to be a partner of my, you know, of the association's attorney.
Right.
And so they feel like there's a disadvantage here. Is there a bit more separation between federal judges and federal courts and what they're doing? Is that part of the reason you'd like to go to federal court, if you can?
Well, that's definitely something to take into account. I mean, I won't say that we choose federal court over state court because we're afraid the state court judges may know the defense attorneys. But that is definitely, you know, in the times we've been in state court, that's definitely a feeling we get. And if it's not the attorney for the other side, it's the attorney from the case prior to the one that we're in. There is definitely a feeling that state court judges who... I'm not sure how they're appointed in Virginia, but in Kentucky we still elect our judges.
There are appointments here, and there seems to be a lot of shoddy stuff going on.
Right. And at least at the federal level, most of the time I think the judges that are appointed by the president are from different places, you know, than the benches they end up on.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes federal judges come from the states that they're in, but occasionally they can be appointed and come from another state, so they won't have any political connections or close ties with the attorneys in that particular state. So that's one more thing to think about when choosing state or federal court, I guess, although I think our main factor for choosing federal court is that it gets people's attention and the recoveries are typically higher for our victims in those cases.
Okay, but you can't always do that because obviously right. if you have something that's just, okay, all right, that's, I was really thrilled when I realized that you were a private organization as opposed to a government agency, because it's nice to know that there are people out there who are doing this sort of work.
Right.
And it was all in here, and I know I read it the first time around, and I just did, you know, it just didn't click, because I've dealt with so many of the government agencies who do this sort of investigating, and they take a long, long, long time to get through some of these. I mean, usually I tell people, file a complaint and it'll, you know, 2 years max, you know, you'll just, pending the outcome of the investigation, you'll be able to do whatever you need to do for a couple of years, and that gives you the breathing room to be able to figure out what's happening. Sometimes you get foreclosure cases. You know, people say, "Hey, I've paid in my assessments." They refuse to accept them. You know, there's some discrepancy in the accounting system, and now they want to foreclose on me.
Right.
And they need a couple more years to find an attorney to represent them, but they tend to be, if they tend to be a, you know, a member of a protected group, I usually say, just go ahead and file a complaint.
Right.
And then, you know, we'll figure out later on, you know, whether there is discrimination or not, but at least you need to be able to save your home.
Right. And that's a great point to bring up. There is one advantage to filing a complaint with HUD or with another government agency, and that's that it stops the statute of limitations from running on your claim. If you're convinced that you've got a discrimination case, but you just haven't gathered enough evidence yet, or you just don't have the evidence yet, if you file a complaint with HUD, then for whatever time HUD takes to investigate that complaint, the statute of limitations stops running. So the statute of limitations on the federal level to file a fair housing lawsuit is 2 years. But for whatever time your complaint is pending with HUD, that 2-year time period stops. So if you file a complaint with HUD, they take 6 months to investigate it. And within that 6 months, you find the evidence you need, or some new evidence turns up, or you're able to find an attorney that you can work with. You can withdraw that complaint from HUD and file in federal court, and you won't have lost your statute of limitations. So that's a great point, and it's good advice for people who may or may not have an attorney yet, or may not be able to find an agency like mine, but who want to make sure that something gets done and they don't lose out by waiting, you know, the 2 years and being left out of the federal system.
So you're saying basically if you think that you're being discriminated against, you better get on it, because once you've only got 2 years to start?
Right. You know, on the federal level, I know in Kentucky that it's only 1 year. And in certain local jurisdictions, for instance, Louisville, Jefferson County, where the Kentucky Fair Housing is, you only have 180 days to file your complaint. So if you suspect discrimination, the best thing to do, my advice is always to try to find a private agency like ours to help you with your case. But if you can't, if you're in part of a country where they don't have private agencies, my suggestion is to file a complaint with HUD right away, and then from that point start digging and doing your own investigation and see if you have a federal lawsuit available to you.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back. Don't go away. We'll be back with Tom.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell.
why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.
WBR Fairfax Radio, you're on the Commons. I'm Shu Bartholomew. On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions, and on the Commons with us today is Tony Bays. Tony is the Assistant Director of the Kentucky Fair Housing Council. This is a private, not-for-profit agency that protects people's rights in housing that are being discriminated by either landlords or realtors. I know that I used to be a realtor, and I know that there were testers out there making sure that we treated everybody equally. And also, good news for you guys out there, also from homeowners associations. And Tony, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Shu.
This is fascinating stuff. How do people know? I mean, you know, so often I get calls from people or I get emails from people and they say, you know, this is what my association's doing to me, because that's, you know, I usually get the association angle, and quite often it sounds like it's discriminatory. And how do we get the word out that there are agencies out there and there are people like Tony Bays out there who are willing to pick up the gauntlet and go protect you? How do we let people know that, Tony?
Well, there's actually a great resource at fairhousing.com. It's a website that was begun by the Kentucky Fair Housing Council and is now operated superbly, I might add, by the good folks at the Tennessee Fair Housing Council. And on the front page, there is an agency locator. All you need to do is click on agency locator and then click on the state that you're in, and you can find listings of all the private nonprofit agencies and all the governmental agencies in your state that handle fair housing complaints. If you have a question about fair housing, I always suggest that you contact a private fair housing group first. The government agencies are great, and they do good work, but a private fair housing agency is on your side from the very beginning. A government agency has to be neutral in their investigation. They have to be impartial to both parties. A private fair housing agency is on your side from the moment you call in, and they often provide you with legal assistance all the way through the process, whether you need to file a lawsuit or file a complaint with your state or local or federal agency.
That's fantastic. That's great news, and that's really great, Tony. So it's fairhousing.com, huh?
That's right, fairhousing.com. It's all one word. And the in addition to the agency finder, there's also a great forum on there where you can log in. You don't even have to log in. You can be a guest, and you can post questions in the Fair Housing forums. Any question you might have about fair housing or any housing issue, really, you can go into the message forums, post your question, and usually within an hour or so, you've got two or three replies from fair housing people around the country. So, again, fairhousing.com, all one word. They do a great job there in Tennessee keeping the website up.
I'm going to put this on my website as well. I'm going to put a link up to this. That's absolutely excellent, excellent advice. Thank you so much, Tony. How do you get your funding?
There is a, like I mentioned earlier, there's the Fair Housing Initiative Program. It's a federal program from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. It's a competitive program. So essentially every year, groups like mine compete with all of our sister agencies around the country for funding to both educate the public about fair housing rights and to enforce the fair housing laws, through lawsuits, complaints, and investigations. The sad news is that the funding for the Fair Housing Initiatives Program has been decreasing in real-world dollars over the past few years, while the funding for government agencies that investigate these types of complaints has been going up. There are more and more fair housing agencies around the country like mine who are having to go out of business because they can't survive more than a year or so without this federal funding. But this federal funding is dwindling, and it's hard to keep folks in place. We also get some funding from the National Fair Housing Alliance. It's a national group which is comprised of, I think, 250 private fair housing agencies like ours around the country. We do some contract work with them. They take on the national issues in fair housing. They take on the Prudential insurances of the world and the Allstates and the Nationwides when they find that those companies have nationwide policies of discrimination. And there are other ways that other groups get funded, but for the most part, my agency is funded by the Fair Housing Initiatives Program and the contract work we do with the National Fair Housing Alliance.
You said at the beginning that you've got more work than you can handle. Is that right? I mean, you're getting a lot more.
That's right.
It's, clients.
It's amazing. I've worked with the Fair Housing Council for about 7 years, and this is the first time when I can remember that we just have too many cases. We don't turn anybody away, but it's almost impossible to keep everybody that we're working for updated on what the status of their cases are. We have about 40 active cases right now, and all of them are in various stages. As soon as we settle one complaint, another comes in, and it's been kind of a difficult period for us. But we're doing well. Most of our cases are moving towards closure, and I think very soon we'll have it all back under control. Additionally, our agency publishes the National Fair Housing Advocate. It's a newsletter. It's a national newsletter that details fair housing cases from around the country. We only publish the victories. We don't publish the ones where our friends lose. But it's a free newsletter, and anybody who's interested in getting a copy they can call me. I'll go ahead and give out our 800 number if that's all right.
That's fine. That's great.
It's 800-558-3247 or 800-558-FAIR. And again, just ask for a subscription to the National Fair Housing Advocate, and we'll put you on our list.
That sounds great. Can they send you an email as well?
They can send me an email as well. My email address is Tony Baize, that's TonyBaize, all one word, at Juno, JUNO.com.
Okay. That's great. That's wonderful. Tony, you said at the beginning you had a case that you've been working on for about 5 years now.
Right.
And you want to tell us about that? Can you talk about it?
Yeah, we are headed to trial on this case on June 2nd. We finally got a trial date. This case involves the development of three condo complexes in Louisville and Jefferson County. And all of these complexes were designed without accessible features for persons with disabilities. Specifically, there are steps at all entrances into the homes. The doorways are too narrow for people who use wheelchairs. The light switches are too high. The electrical outlets are too low. The thermostats are too high. The bathrooms are not reinforced so that if a person with a disability needs to install grab bars, they could do so. It's just there's a whole slew of problems at three different complexes that we investigated, and the defendants have successfully stalled this case out for about 5 years, even though the evidence is clear. The evidence is right there. You can drive up and see the steps at the front doors, and it only takes a measuring tape to realize that the doors are not wide enough for somebody who's in a wheelchair. This is a case that we've been working on. We're going to trial on June 2nd. We hope that the judge rules in our favor and orders the folks to retrofit and make the changes at these complexes so that persons with disabilities can get in and out of these homes. I guess the most interesting thing about this case is that most of the people who live in these homes are people over the age of 50. And quite a few that we met and talked with recently have mobility impairments. We met with one lady who uses a wheelchair, and before her unit was even built, she requested that her thermostat be put at a height she could reach. And the developers said that they would do it, but that they would charge her $75 to do it. And she didn't have a lot of money anyway, so she refused to pay it. So to this day, when she wants to change the temperature in her home, she has to call one of her neighbors to come over and adjust her thermostat.
You're kidding.
That's, and it's been illegal since 1988 to build multifamily housing that doesn't meet these accessibility requirements. But it still happens. A recent survey showed that as much as 80% of all multifamily housing being built today still does not comply with these laws.
Let me ask you, this brings up a couple of questions in my mind. Number one, is there an overlap with ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act? But number two, what happened to the inspectors, the county or state or no, the building inspectors that are supposed to be inspecting these buildings as they are being constructed?
Those are two great questions. And the second question is one that the defendants in this case have brought up many times. The first question, whether or not there's some overlap with the ADA and the Fair Housing Act, there's some minor overlap. The ADA only applies to public areas, to shopping malls, to movie theaters, to stadiums, to museums, and if there's anything in a particular development, you know, a common area, a playground, or a clubhouse, you know, anything that the public has access to in a private housing development, that would be covered by the ADA. Residential housing, however, is only covered by the Fair Housing Act. The ADA does not apply. The ADA gets a lot of publicity and a lot of press because a lot of lawsuits are filed citing the ADA. Not so many are filed with the Fair Housing Act, although the Fair Housing Act precedes the amendments that added disability, precede the ADA by a couple of years. As to your second question about where were the inspectors, that's a great question. And the best answer, well, I don't know if it's the best answer, but the honest answer is that building inspectors only look at local and state building codes. They don't bother to check civil rights codes to see, or civil rights laws to see if additional requirements are required for multifamily housing. And that's what happened in Kentucky. The building inspectors looked at the Kentucky State Building Code. They saw that the plans that the defendants in our case submitted were compliant with the Kentucky State Building Code, and they approved them. There has been a senator in Kentucky, a state senator, for the last three or four sessions who's been trying to get the Fair Housing Act requirements adopted into Kentucky State's building codes, and each time his bill is either bottled up in committee or voted down. Yes, the state building inspectors should have seen these problems, and they should have known about these problems, but they didn't because they weren't in the building codes. Recently, we at the Fair Housing Council in Kentucky, we have begun training local building inspectors to look for these types of things, and we have gotten them to agree to put a stamp on all plans that says essentially, are your units accessible? Federal and state law requires that your multifamily units be accessible to persons with disabilities. If you need more information, call the Fair Housing Council.
So basically they're kicking it over to you.
Exactly.
Again,
they don't feel that they're responsible for the fair housing requirements, and at this point we're not sure if they are or not. We feel that it's better if somebody is looking out for it, and that right now is us. But we're, you know, right now, as long as the fair housing requirements aren't in the state building codes, they're not going to look for them.
And you said the senator's been trying to get this in the requirements, and his bill's just been killed.
Right. For the last, I'd say since 1997, Senator David Karam has been trying to get the Fair Housing Act requirements passed into the Kentucky building codes, but I don't know if he's meeting severe opposition from the home builders or from who, but each time he brings this bill up, it either never reaches the floor for a vote or it loses on vote.
Yeah, that's happening a lot in a lot of homeowner association issues, especially with the flag nowadays. Just about every state's looking at enacting legislation that would protect the homeowner's right to fly a flag.
Right.
And it's getting killed in committee. Nobody wants it to go on the floor and get voted down, but it's getting killed in committee all over the place, which is completely disgusting. Would it be easier to have something done at the federal level?
Yeah, it really would be. And, you know, I know that HUD has spent a lot of money trying to educate home builders. They had, you know, they built a three-year moratorium into the law when it passed in 1988. They gave builders 3 years to get up to speed on the types of changes they need to make to their housing, and it's just been ignored. HUD, again last year, gave a lot of money to the National Association of Home Builders so that that association could train its members in the fair housing requirements. But from what we see, those requirements are, for the most part, still being ignored.
Now, a lot of this stuff sounds like it's basically not going to cost the builder anything additional. Whether you put the light switches up or down, you know, it's a matter of placement, right?
Exactly. And that's what's so, you know, disturbing about people we find who may have known about these requirements but just decided to ignore them. The defendants in the case I was speaking about a minute ago actually had a copy of the Fair Housing Act guidelines in the plans, but they took them out. They bought the plans from a franchisor architect in Ohio, and the franchisor architect had Fair Housing guidelines in the plans, but our defendants took them out. So it's really bothersome to see that kind of stuff. And you're right, it doesn't cost builders much more. I think a study done by HUD several years ago showed that it only costs about 1% more to build housing that's accessible as compared to inaccessible. And that 1% comes in things like wider doors, essentially. I think that's probably the biggest expense you're going to run into is wider doors.
What about
how
about reinforced bathrooms so that people can pull themselves up? I mean, if you're going to put a bar up there, you don't want the bar coming out.
Right.
So you're going to have to build it with something other than scotch tape and cardboard, right?
Exactly. essentially, you know, to reinforce the bathroom, you've got to put, you know, a series of studs in bathroom walls. I mean, you can't just have the normal 16-inch studs in the walls, because grab bars don't come in those types of standard sizes. I think the standard grab bar is 24 inches. So if you've got studs that are 16 inches apart, unless you tilt it, and often the position of a grab bar depends on the disability of the person who needs the grab bar, unless you can tilt it just right, you're not going to be able to hit the studs, and that's why you need the additional reinforcements in your bathroom.
So basically we're talking about an additional stud or two. And which may cost a couple of bucks.
Right.
And wider doors.
Right.
Because certainly moving the door frames around is not going to be that much more expensive.
Right.
There you go. You can save a stud from a wider door, and that takes care of that, right?
Right, exactly. And what people fail to realize is that, you know, almost 5% of America's population has mobility impairments. And that 20% of America's population has some form of disability. Building accessible housing just makes sense because it opens up your housing to a wider market of people. I have arthritis that may or may not cost me my ability to walk in a few years. And if that's the case, I'm going to be looking to buy a home or a condo, or look to move into an apartment where I can get around with the use of whatever mobility aid I'm using.
And there are laws in the fair housing laws that say that you have to have these things in new housing, right?
Right. Now, let me clarify before people start freaking out that the federal law only applies to multifamily housing where there are four units or more under the same roof. So if you have a condo development and it's a pinwheel style home, or it's an apartment style home, if there are four units or more and there's an elevator in the building, then every unit in that building has to be accessible. If there's no elevator and there are four units or more, then every unit on the ground floor has to be accessible.
Okay.
I know in Kentucky that number gets dropped down to two units per building. So if you're in Kentucky and you build a duplex, and assuming you build a duplex, you know, the units are side by side instead of one on top of the other, then the ground, you know, then both units have to be accessible. I'm not sure if Virginia state law drops that down any further, but I know many, many states do.
Okay. So basically there are some laws in place that are not being enforced by the real government. Is that correct?
Well, that's absolutely correct. And I know the Justice Department has gone after many, many builders and developers because they failed to design buildings accessibly. But for the most part, these design and construction errors are being ignored, and it's hard to figure out why the government doesn't take more of an interest in this type of discrimination than they do.
Now, there are, I know there are some architects who specialize in mobility and in handicapped access housing, and there are a lot of little things that can be done, for instance, changing the doorknobs.
Right.
Instead of having a round doorknob where, you know, if you have arthritis and it gets a little bit hard to do, you can have a lever type of doorknob, and you just sort of push down on it.
Right.
And, it, you know, you can even have a pet open a door with a lever type doorknob.
Yeah, that's right. And that's actually one of the requirements under the Federal Fair Housing Act is that on the main entrance door in multifamily housing, you need to have a lever hardware set instead of a knob. Because as you mentioned, you have people with arthritis, and people without, you know, without hands, you know, have a very tough time twisting and turning a knob, whereas a lever allows them to simply push down and open the door.
There's so many things that we do without even thinking. I mean, I never even thought about your thermostat, but it could get very uncomfortable in there if you've got the heat on.
Exactly.
And you need the air conditioning on, and you can't reach the thermostat.
That's exactly right, and that's why Congress passed the law, and that's why HUD issued regulations explaining to builders what they needed to do to comply with the law. I mean, quite honestly, the HUD regulations that are the bare minimum that builders need to follow aren't, you know, don't make units fully accessible. You know, it still leaves much to be desired, but it at least it's a starting point for a person with a mobility impairment who needs to make changes to their apartment or their home later.
Tony, thank you so much for joining us today. We're out of time. You've given us so much information.
Well, thank you for having me, Sue. I really enjoyed it.
I enjoyed having you, and I've learned a tremendous amount from you. Let's make sure that people know how to reach you and how to get the information they need, because, folks, everywhere you go, you're probably, you know, running into someone who is being discriminated against, and you're going to want to get some help in housing, and that's fairhousing.com, right?
That's correct.
And if you want to get the National Fair Housing Advocate, how often does that come out?
It's a monthly publication, and we have just been funded to do another year's worth of issues.
I definitely want one of those. I will send you my address. And I'd like to be on your mailing list to get as much information as I can. And so if you guys are interested and you want to know what's going on in fair housing, why don't you call, give us the 800 number again, Tony?
It's 800-558-3247.
Okay. So you can call and you can ask to receive the Fair Housing Advocate. While you're about it, you might want to drop your legislators a note and ask them to continue funding the good work that these folks are doing, because it seems that they're doing what your government allegedly should be doing, but they're not. Good luck with your federal court case, and I hope, you know, like I said, it doesn't seem like there's a whole lot in there that's going to be that costly for the developer if they would only start thinking. So good luck with that. I really hope you win.
Thank you.
And On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions. See you all next week. Thanks for joining us.